Hey everyone, this is John, and this is The Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. As you can tell, I am solo. It's been a while since I've done a solo show. We were planning on a Pokemon show, because it would be the first show for the month of May 2022. Usually we start the month off with a Pokemon show. We were going to do a quiz game. Wes had to bail at the last minute, probably about an hour before we were scheduled to get together to do a recording. So because it was a quiz show, we can't just do it with one person. So we decided just to reschedule the entire thing. So the day after, I decided I'm going to do a solo show. We'll reshuffle things. This will kind of be a mini show of sorts. I'm going to talk about mostly games, but I do have a couple of non-gaming things that maybe I'll get to at the end, depending on how long I go. Sometimes I'm pretty brisk with this. Sometimes I go a little bit long-winded. We'll see how this one goes, and we'll play it by ear. So let's get things started. There is a bit of news, Nintendo adjacent, but not really directly involved in Nintendo news, but Square Enix started selling off a lot of assets, particularly development studios and intellectual properties that go along with them, from a lot of their European and North American branches, pretty much the Western side of the Square Enix business, Eidos, Crystal Dynamics, pretty much anything associated with Western franchises in Square Enix. They sold those off to the parent company, whose name is escaping me right now, who also has THQ Nordic as an asset. So kind of bringing these things into a larger umbrella. And their company, and THQ Nordic as well, is a company that does a lot of these acquisitions. But this parent company acquired these studios and associated intellectual properties, things like Tomb Raider, from Square Enix, in exchange for cash, of course, $300 million, which, you know, definitely not the sort of ballooned, inflated price that went along with purchasing Activision Blizzard when Microsoft did that several months back. It is a bit disturbing when, you know, the conversation around this purchase is how it sold for so little. $300 million is not a pittance. It is not over $1 billion. So, you know, without all those extra zeros or that B, it's considered a small amount of money. This is not a small amount of money. A lot of cash is going to exchange hands here in exchange for these studios and intellectual properties. There's also been a bit of speculation about why Square Enix would do this. And, you know, some of it has been about, you know, these franchises not performing super well. And some of the numbers that have been discussed about these studios and their sort of profit margins, I suppose, have been about, you know, they don't make a ton of money. And I think it is reasonable to assume that in a sort of capitalistic view of things, that if these development houses, these games aren't producing a large enough profit margin, which, you know, some of the gossip has been, you know, as little as like a 0.5% to like 3% profit margin on some of these productions and development studios, that's not enough to justify continuing ownership of these things. So they decided just to flip them and cut ties. I could see that as a possible rationalization in a capitalistic economy and business practice. It's not enough that they make some money. They need to have like this minimum viable profit margin, which, you know, a 3% profit margin isn't much, but it is profit. And I don't know, I just, it leaves a bad taste in my mouth if this is actually a justification or a reason for wanting to part ways with these studios, that, you know, not enough money is being made here. I find that kind of gross. And some of the other speculation about these acquisitions is that there's, of course, ongoing rumors. These rumors have been going on for quite some time about Sony making an acquisition of Square Enix, and this sort of shedding off of the Western side of their development studios is a way of maybe making it easier for Sony to acquire. I don't know. I don't entirely buy that. Sony is a multinational company. I don't think that they would, you know, have to deal with anything they haven't dealt with before with acquiring a company that has studios in both Japan and, you know, North America and Europe. It does not seem like a too big of a hurdle that Sony would have to overcome. Square Enix trying to get a little bit more liquid to stave off some sort of acquisition. I don't know. Either way, you know, whether this is something that's, you know, total gossip that has no basis in truth, or something that Sony is exploring and Square Enix is, you know, either trying to fight off or make easier, I do think it's also repugnant to have all of these acquisitions happening with Activision Blizzard and Bungie and all these studios becoming, you know, part of the larger platform holder studios or conglomerates and publishers and platform holders. You know, I think it's very hurtful to, you know, game development in general to have things existing within one big corporate overlord structure. You know, for the examples I was talking about with like minimum viable profit margins and that sort of need to make a certain amount of money in order to continue existing, you know, that that sort of capitalistic attitude about, you know, something that's supposed to be an art form, I just find distasteful, and I don't think that the bigger fish swallowing up the smaller fish helps advance any sort of art form. And of course, I do have an invested interest as a Nintendo fan that this does not happen, because I want Square Enix games to continue to appear on Nintendo platforms. Games like, you know, Triangle Strategy, one of the bigger Switch releases so far this year, in the first half of the year. You know, it was from Square Enix and was a project that wasn't this huge blockbuster. I don't know that Sony would allow those sort of projects to continue as they have been, like something like a Live Alive remake, something like bringing games like Saga Frontier over to Switch. You know, we don't know for sure that Sony would allow games to come to Switch, you know, if they were to swallow up Square Enix in this fashion. You know, I don't presume whenever a Sony or a Microsoft or Nintendo buys up a studio, I don't presume that those games will be coming to competing platforms at all. We've already seen, you know, the hedging that Microsoft has done with Bethesda, and they've outright confirmed that there will be games going forward that are going to be exclusive to Microsoft platforms, Xbox and PC, when these Bethesda games come out. And you got the lip service at first, like, oh, we have no plans to, you know, change anything. And then you get the lip service, or you get the excuse after the fact, like, oh, in order to, you know, make the best possible product, it's got to be only on these platforms. So, and when Sony bought up Bungie, they said that they'd be continuing to have multi-platform stuff. And I think it's pretty safe to assume that at some point, games that are made by Bungie are going to be like PlayStation and maybe PC only. You know, you don't buy up these things. You don't make all these acquisitions. And I've said it 1,000 times before, you don't do these things with games that are already coming to your platform. You're not paying all of this money just for the privilege of putting those games and to pay your competitors to license the games on their platforms. What you're buying is exclusivity. That's what you're paying the millions and the billions for. Anyway, I digress. And, you know, there have been, not to exclude Nintendo from this, there have been acquisitions made by Nintendo. I think the most notable one in the past year or so was Next Level Games. I would file that under like extenuating circumstances, because this was a development company that had a relationship with Nintendo, and the founder/owner was going to retire and sell off the company. So just in order to maintain the relationship, it made sense for Nintendo to buy them. And they weren't really putting out content on other systems. At the time, they've pretty much been working exclusively with Nintendo for quite some time now. So, you know, the acquisition made sense for Nintendo, and it's good that those games will continue to be on Nintendo systems. We're not depriving anyone else of next-level games developments by buying them up. And, you know, it seemed to be the best possible option to keep that relationship with that development house going. You know, would it have been nice if they could continue that relationship without buying them or making a significant investment in them? Sure, that would have been nice, but you know, the owner was going to sell the company to, you know, whoever was going to buy it. It's good that Nintendo was able to be the one to buy it, because if it was Microsoft that bought them, we would not be seeing Next Level working on another Luigi's Mansion, which would be a shame. So, it's a weird... The game industry, as we talk about every now and then on the Retro Show, the game industry is just always in a state of transition as it grows and evolves. It's grown very quickly. It's very much an art form that's still in its adolescence. This is not mature in the way that, you know, literature or film has matured over decades and centuries. This is still a very young art form and very lucrative, and it's a dangerous combination. So hopefully, you know, things will work out in a way that we get quality games, a variety of games, and we see a lot of diversity within games, and it just doesn't become the same things over and over again. So, with that in mind, I do have some Switch games that I want to talk about. Kind of close the book on a couple of these that I've been playing before, you know, we get on to the official show at the end of the month and we talk about some other new games. Let's see, I played Trains of Ruby. That is a game that I touched on briefly, hadn't started it yet, but I mentioned that it was coming out on the official show last week. It was not out when we recorded, but now it is. I played through it. I finished it. It's not a long game. It took me 8, maybe 9 hours. I think if you really know what you're doing, if you've played through the game once, you can probably finish it in half that time. There is a good amount of sort of like a fetching, like bringing like now that I think of it, I think I did talk about this one on the official show. It was out and I had played a little bit of it. But because I remember mentioning that there were times where you had to like get a card key that opened a door, but the door was like across the map, and then there's another door blocking your way, and you had to go all the way back, pick up another card key from like a similar location, and then head all the way back. So there's a lot of time spent traversing the similar terrain several times. And you know, once you understand the way the map works in this game, let's rewind for a second. This is, I described it before as a take on Castlevania, and I think that's very much the case, because, you know, dissimilar from Metroid, there are not a whole lot of new abilities that you pick up. You know, you get a double jump and you get the ability to sort of like transform into a bike, which will give you like a dash. It'll do some damage, and it will allow you to move over certain types of terrain, water, or if there's small gaps in terrain, you'll be able to glide over that. So those are the two major power-ups that you get. Everything else is sort of upgrades to your ammo for your gun that will freeze enemies and turn them into platforms, for your HP, and for your sword, kind of give you a greater, you know, arc to your swing, a greater range on your melee attack. So other than that, like, you're not really gaining any upgrades. So it's not really, you're not using your new skills to engage in combat or open up new areas in different ways. You're pretty much like finding an item, which is where this, you know, the Castlevania comparisons come in. It is structured in the way like a Castlevania or a Metroid would be structured, but the difference is in a Castlevania, it has less to do with new skills that you're getting and more to do with the new thing that you're finding. You know, you beat a boss and it gives you access to another area by virtue of a an item or maybe an incantation or something. Something that's not going to be a direct upgrade to the way that you are, you know, traversing or engaging in any sort of combat. It's just like the golden key that's going to open the door for you. And Transarubia is very much in that vein, where instead of getting, you know, a morph ball and a grapple and a spider ball and all these different things that are letting you move differently and attack differently, it's just, here's your card key, here's your key to this gate, here's all of your little collectibles that are going to open up that gate for you. Sometimes in a game like a Castlevania or Transarubia, there are times when you're not 100% sure of the direction you should be going next, because maybe you've passed by something and didn't quite notice that it was something that was closed off to you that's going to open up later. Sometimes something will open up and you don't quite realize what it is that you've done or how you've affected things in order to progress to the next area. And that's where the map comes in handy, to circle back around to that. Once you understand the information it is telling you, it's pretty directly telling you, you know, where your upgrades are, where you should be heading next, where all of your little collectibles are, if you want to go for that sort of thing. Some collectibles are required to open up gates. So you don't ever have to do any sort of hunting around for, you know, you have little golden coins, and there are points in the game, several points of the game, where there is a gate you have to get through that's going to require 50 of them. You pretty much have to collect all of these golden coins, the little token things, throughout the entire game in order to finish it. But they're marked on your map, kind of like on a grid, the general area they're going to be. So if you find yourself like, hey, I have 48 out of 50 I need, you're going to know the general area you're going to have to go back to. If you found a power-up or a key card in this case, it's going to show you on your map the direction, the square on the grid where you want to go to use that sort of thing. So it's very direct in the way that it's displaying this information to you about where you should be going. That said, there are times where it's going to display information to you like, this is where you need to go, but the terrain is a little bit tricky, where it's not going to be like a direct route to get to that spot. Or once you get to that area of the map, you have to finagle the terrain in a certain way or find like a hidden pathway in order to get to the location you need to get to. So it's not, you know, just chasing your waypoints. There is a little bit of exploration you still need to do. And, you know, there are times when the way they design the levels isn't what you would call intuitive, because there's like a secret room, an invisible wall, something that wouldn't be blatantly obvious. So you might think, oh, okay, I must not be able to accomplish this thing yet. There must be something else I need to do in order to, you know, make my way back here once I have the correct gear, the correct amount of progression in order to access this particular part that I think I need to be in. That is hardly ever the case. Like I was saying, the map is going to tell you if it seems like, you know, you're not able to jump high enough to get to the place where the map is telling you need to be there. If it seems like, you know, there's like a password that you need that you haven't found yet, it is close by. They're always hiding these things close by. I know that sort of knowledge is important going into the game, because there were points where I was doing a lot of wandering because I wasn't trusting that I was in the right spot. The game isn't complicated. It's not trying to trick you. It's always sending you to the place you need to be. And I think, like, overall, I had a pretty good time with it. There are four distinct areas in the game. Eventually you do unlock some fast travel spots between each area. And I think, like, when the game it was running the risk of being a little bit long in the tooth, but once you get to the fourth area, it changes up the gameplay in a significant way by having areas of the level where you're actually kind of like free flying around on this this plane, the ship, and it becomes more of a like a shooter, like a side-scrolling arcade shooter in certain points, while still maintaining the Castlevania-like gameplay of having to find the right items and beat the right bosses in a certain order. It was a really interesting segment, and you know, whereas it could have been just more of the same of the other three areas, having such a different style to that fourth area really made it engrossing to engage with that spot, where it could have been just kind of another area to slog through that was like the other ones. I think, you know, once you get into the seventh and eighth hour of the game, it probably would have started to feel a lot samey, I guess is the word I'm looking for. But it did not, because they're able to mix it up pretty well. So big thumbs up to them on that one. I think this is a worthwhile little game. I think it was like 15 or 20 bucks. I'd say keep an eye on this one. It was developed by Skip Limited, I think is the name of the developer. They did another one on the Switch way, way back, I think close to the Switch launch, called Comico, which was a game that I thought was pretty fun. And they also did games that I think were on the 3DS called Faerûn, which I think I might have played one of those. I think there were a couple of them that came out on the 3DS eShop. But yeah, they're a smaller like pixel art indie development company, and they usually do things that are fairly interesting, like not like super top quality stuff, but they're cool little games. The other game that I played there, I bought Figment. It was on deep discount, and there's a sequel announced for this game, I think earlier this year, or late last year, coming to the Switch at some point. I think it got delayed a little bit. This was supposed to come out in May, but I think got pushed back. But neither here nor there. The first one was on deep discount. It's usually like 20 bucks. It was on sale for $2, and I used gold coins to get it for free. This game I'm not quite as high on as I am with Transruby. It was fine. So what it is a like a isometric like top-down view puzzle game, in the way that, you know, some Zelda puzzles work, with, you know, using the correct item to place, sliding things around, making sure certain switches are depressed, turning cogs in order to open up your path forward. You know, nothing super complicated. There is some inventory management. There are like batteries you need to pick up and put down in different spots in order to, you know, raise one bridge but lower another, that sort of thing. There is some combat to it. It's pretty rudimentary, and I was a little bit annoyed when it would come up. I just wanted to keep on progressing with the puzzles of the game, because those are pretty good. There are a couple of boss fights as well, and the boss fights I think have an interesting layer to it, because it's more about solving a puzzle in order to, you know, engage with the boss, rather than like sort of these twitch mechanics to like directly engage with combat in a boss fight. So I think there was an interesting approach to boss fights in that respect. It looks all right. It's a little bit of an older game. I think it originally came out back in 2017 or 2018. So, you know, it looks fine. They do like their little songs that they sing, especially when bosses appear. They're pretty proud of those. I think it's going to be like a major feature of the sequel that's coming out at some point this year. And, you know, it was fine. It wasn't really my thing. I didn't really care much for the songs. And, you know, I think this game is okay. I wasn't super enthusiastic about trying the new one when it comes out. I think this kind of even dampened that what little enthusiasm that I had dampened a little bit more. It's okay, but it's a game, Figment 2, I might stick on a wish list and wait for another deep discount before I give it a shot. But I think I've had enough of that sort of style with the first one, so I'll probably end up passing on the second one. Let's see, play a bit more of Switch Sports. I do not have currently a Nintendo Online subscription, so I have not played online. I've just been playing single player. Not really too much to report back on that. I've mostly been playing bowling as well as tennis, are the ones I'm most familiar with. I did play a little bit of volleyball, which seemed pretty cool. I think it's one of the more complex sports, certainly compared to something like a bowling or a tennis, because there are specific motions that it wants you to do in order to sort of, you know, dig, set, and then spike. And there's also some defensive maneuvers like blocking that it wants you to do. That seems okay. That'd probably be funner with, you know, a team of people rather than just doing a 1v computer sort of setup that I was doing. So like, it's funny though, because I think it would be better with like a four players sort of situation where everyone's playing volleyball together. But I think that would be quite a crowded space to like have four people playing volleyball in a living room together like that. I don't know, a bit of a catch 22 in that respect. But, you know, maybe I'll get around to trying that at some point. I do want to try the soccer sport next. I haven't tried that one yet at all. So maybe I'll report back on that one when I get to it. Still really looking forward to golf, though. I really like the Wii Sports Golf. Hopefully baseball makes a comeback as well at some point. But I'm digging the fact that they're going to be adding more to this, because I'd really like to get back into some golf. And, I've been playing Pokemon Diamond as well. I rolled credits on that earlier today. I finished off Wes's copy of Diamond. There's this annoying thing that happens in these remakes where it won't unlock the National Dex. The reason I'm playing through this game is so I can unlock the National Dex in Diamond, so I can do like some catching of some version exclusives, so I can trade back to my version of Pearl and finish off my living decks in that version. Because, I don't know, it doesn't seem like Pokemon Home support is coming anytime soon. Hopefully I just jinxed it and I'll just be able to finish out the living decks and things from home and then transfer it all over. But in lieu of being able to access all of my Pokemon in Home, I'm trying to get through Diamond so that I can get all those version exclusives. But it does this annoying thing where it doesn't unlock the National Dex for you until you've seen every Pokemon in the Sinnoh Dex, all those 150. Which, you know, there is opportunity to do all that by the time you're done with the Elite Four. You can play straight through the game as long as you're engaging with everything so that you see... you don't have to catch everyone, obviously. You just have to see them and have that data available in your Pokedex. I finished Elite Four 3 missing. I was able to hatch a Riolu egg and see an unknown really quick. But the one that I'm missing is a Drifloon. There is a trainer in the game that has a Drifloon. And it is a junior member of a gym in Hearthstone City. And I've already beaten that gym. I can't go back through and challenge that trainer again. So now I have to wait until a Friday to get one of those from Valley Windworks. Tomorrow I'm going to try to adjust the date to my Switch to see if I can just manipulate it into, you know, seeing a Drifloon. Maybe there'll be one in like the battle frontier, the battle tower in that game to where I can see one. Otherwise, I'm just kind of sitting around till Friday until I could just go to the Valley Windworks and get one. And I should have done this earlier, but I was playing through the game using a specific class of Pokemon. We talked about this on a previous Pokemon show where, you know, we were talking about like doing a rogue class, so using only dark and poison types. And I ran through that, and it I'll get into some more details in the Pokemon show when we do that again. But It was pretty fun, and I liked the Pokemon I was using, but I'm a little bit annoyed that now, you know, I'm to the point where, you know, I wanted to get to so I can start making progress in my other game, but I've kind of been halted here in making progress. So a little bit miffed by that. Oh, I'm also playing Oracle of Ages, and I'll talk more about that when we get to it on the retro show in a couple of weeks. But big thumbs up to that game. I have beaten 3 dungeons now. I went through my favorite section of the game, where you go through the Crescent Island area, where, you know, you lose all your items, and then you have to, you know, solve the puzzle of how to get them all back and then access the dungeon in that area. Really, really cool. I always really dig going through that. But yeah, it's an impressive game for working on such old hardware on the Game Boy Color. You know, it doesn't really have, you know, much of an improved scope in terms of like the size of the world and the size of the dungeons, I think, when compared to Link's Awakening. Link's Awakening probably did a lot to, you know, fully utilize what they could on the Game Boy back when it originally released. So, you know, they're still working with the same tool set, a little bit more advanced with the Game Boy Color. But it seems like they used a lot of the, you know, extra limited power they had available to expand the sort of the scope of the narrative of the game with all of the different characters and little cut scenes that happen when it cuts away from Link and shows you some of the other goings on in the world. But yeah, I really love Oracle of Ages. I played through it maybe a year and a half or 2 years ago at this point, but giving it another run. I don't know that I'll be able to do the same with Seasons right away, because there are some other games that I want to get to before I go back to that one. But hopefully I'll be able to give a little bit of time to Seasons at some point in the next couple of months and, you know, actually give that one some attention. When it comes to those two games, I've always preferred Ages over Seasons, but you know, Seasons is a super ambitious game. I think it's got more ambition than Oracle of Ages. Oracle of Ages, you're flipping back and forth between two time periods, the past and the present, whereas Oracle of Seasons, every screen that you're going to go to has a state where, you know, it's one of the four seasons. So there's a lot more happening in the world, and the way you're interacting with the world is going to be different depending on what topography is going to be affected by the season that you're in. And there's also an underground world in Oracle of Seasons as well. So there's a lot happening in that game. Really, really ambitious design for a Game Boy Color. But I digress. One other gaming thing, Nintendo related, that I wanted to talk about is E3. We did mention, of course, how it was canceled. And we were talking a little bit in the Discord group if we think that Nintendo is going to be doing, you know, their typical presentation, their direct, their digital event, as they've taken to calling it, during E3. And I think they will. I wouldn't put it past them to not do it in June, to have something in July or August. I think it's going to be very important to them to sort of line up the rest of the year, 2022, because we know fairly well what's going to be happening up until July. And we do know about Splatoon 3 in September. Everything else is a little bit nebulous. I think we can probably pencil in Pokemon for November, but there are still a number of games, specifically ones like Bayonetta 3, Mario plus Rabbids, that we don't know specific release dates for. And I think that they probably still have a game or two that is going to be announced for the back end of this year. So, you know, things get more nebulous when we get past July. We don't really have a big release for August, but, you know, Xenoblade 3 is coming out like 2 days before the 1st of August. So, you know, that'll be, you know, carrying a lot of momentum forward into that month. We don't have anything concrete for October, November, December yet. So, you know, still a little bit of information that needs to get out. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see how they handle this, if they kind of proceed as if, you know, as normal as they do every year with a presentation sometime in mid-June, or if they hold off even longer. I mean, I could see a situation to where they're not doing a presentation until after Splatoon 3 is out. That's possible. Wouldn't be very fun to be waiting that long for Nintendo Direct, but, you know, brace yourselves, because I could see that happening. But hopefully we get one sooner rather than later. Hopefully we got the regular one coming in June. Time will tell. We'll know in about 4 weeks. Last up, as far as games, I wanted to talk briefly about Horizon Zero Dawn. I started that one up a couple weeks ago. I'm pretty much only playing on my days off work a couple hours a day. And it's an interesting game, especially in the context of having played Breath of the Wild twice since it came out. And this is a game, Horizon Zero Dawn, that came out in the same month of Breath of the Wild. And, you know, visuals notwithstanding, you know, graphical fidelity notwithstanding, comparing Horizon Zero Dawn to Breath of the Wild is like comparing a last gen game to a current gen game. Breath of the Wild just feels, you know, miles ahead in terms of, you know, the openness of the design, the ambition of the size of the world, the ambition of, you know, how it is that you're interacting with the world. Horizon Zero Dawn feels very much stuck in the past, whereas Breath of the Wild was trying to reach into the future, trying to do something new. Horizon Zero Dawn feels very restrictive. You know, you have this map that you open up, you see the geography of the world, and there are just flat out places you can't go. Like, there are barriers set up, usually in topography. You can't climb things. There are very specific scripted areas where you can climb on things. There are a lot of icons, tons of icons scattered around the map. And you can filter through this. And I'm probably going to start filtering out some things, because there's everything from, like, enemy encampments to just like groups of enemies that are clustered together, to collectibles, towns and villages, save points. Fucking save points. I mean, is it the PS1? Why the fuck are there save points in this game? Why can't you just save? I don't know. For whatever reason, they decided to scatter all these campfires all over the place. That makes no sense in the sort of context of the world. Everything feels cluttered and claustrophobic in Horizon Zero Dawn. I mean, even the way you're engaging in combat feels very restrictive. Whereas, you know, in something like Breath of the Wild, there's a ton of different ways you can approach how you're going to engage with an enemy, and not just in terms of like at range or stealth or head on, just in the way like the world interacts with the enemies and you interact with the world, and how you can use, you know, the world of Hyrule as a tool in order to dispatch of enemies in all these different ways. Nintendo took this idea of openness and applied it to everything about the game, whereas the developer of Horizon Zero Dawn, openness just meant big. Which is a large scale. And it's not particularly fun to go off the path. There are times when, like, a lot of the places you can get to, there's like an actual, there's a path, there's a road that you take to get there. You know, there are obstacles, like groups of enemies that you're going to come across along your way. There's going to be certain side quests that come up along the way. But it's not fun to leave the road, because then it's just easy to get lost. There's nothing, or not really easy to get lost. You have a map, but there's not anything that you engage with off the path unless there's a group of enemies that you want to sneak up on and take out. There's not anything rewarding about, you know, going over the ridge and seeing what's there. There's a lot of stuff. There's enemies and like materials that you can gather, and like even like just gathering materials, like they completely whiffed on just the mechanic of picking things up, because anytime you want to pick something up, like your character Aloy has to like bend down and gather it, and you know it doesn't take long, but it breaks your stride. You're just trying to move throughout the world and pick something up real quick. And games like Breath of the Wild, even Xenoblade, back in fucking 2011, 2012, had it right to where, you know, you just walk over the thing and you get it. I want to be picking up stuff because there is a, you know, crafting is the way you upgrade a lot of different things in the game, from, you know, your inventory space to your weapons and your materials, just like crafting, like medicine and potions and shit. Like, you want to have a lot of materials available to you. But my goodness, it is a chore. It doesn't even have like a basic lock-on feature. And I think I understand why. Like, it wants you to engage with these different mechanics of like laying traps and dealing with enemies in creative ways, where it's just like locking on, it's going to encourage you more to just take on an enemy one-on-one. But my goodness, like, I think they would have been better served to have a lock-on. And if they want to encourage traps, make the traps more successful. There have been times where I've laid traps, but then just found it really frustrating to either wait for an enemy to cross paths with it or try to lure them over a trap. I don't know. It's the primary way I've engaged with enemies now is just kind of crawl on the tall grass and snipe them as best I can. And then, you know, hit them with my spear when things go a little bit pear-shaped. I don't know. Like, I don't think that it is a bad game. I think that it is mechanically sound. Like, I think they made a lot of smart decisions when it comes to like having all of these crafting materials available to you. How they handle restoring your HP. The stealth mechanics all work really well. It's fun. Not only like most effective, but also fun to engage with the stealth stuff and try to snipe out enemies. It gives you a lot of side quests. I don't think they're particularly like laid out well in terms of how they're conveying you to the next area, but it gives you a lot of side quests. It's got a good sense of forward momentum. There's a skill tree that allows you to spec out, you know, your character Aloy in interesting ways. You can go a couple of different routes, or you can try to do a little bit of everything. I think that the game is sound. I don't think it's particularly inspired, and I think it's stuck in the past. It makes me a little bit leery about Forbidden West, because what I hear about that game is it does a lot of the same things. It's sort of like the same philosophy, design philosophy of Zero Dawn. Maybe that's not the case. At some point, I'll try it. But Zero Dawn is not a game that I'm getting lost in. There are times where, you know, I'll say, okay, I'm going to try to play a couple hours of this game today on my day off. And I'll go to save it and be like, okay, how long have I been playing? Okay, half an hour. Let's go a little bit more. I've never had a situation where, like, okay, how long have I been playing? Oh, God, it's been like 3 hours. It doesn't have like those engrossing exploration features like Breath of the Wild. So a bit unfortunate for this game, because, you know, I do think it's a game that's worth trying out if you like, you know, large scale action games. But a bit unfortunate that this game came out in the same month of Breath of the Wild, because Breath of the Wild just does so many things so much better than this game does. But neither here nor there, because those games are both old right now. I think, like, okay, final take. If you're wondering, should I play Horizon Zero Dawn or play Breath of the Wild again? Play Breath of the Wild again. You'll get so much more out of it. So, a couple other things that I wanted to talk about, some non-gaming things before I finish out here. The hardcover for Inferno, the new X-Men storyline, came out. I read through that. It's 4 issues, but they're larger sized issues. I don't know if they're, you know, giant size issues, but, you know, they're not like the typical 23-page. They're a bit longer than that. And it is a story of bringing back Destiny, Irene, the precognitive mutant character who was killed off in the late 80s. Yeah, definitely the late 80s. But Magneto and Xavier had been reluctant to resurrect her because Moira McTaggart noted mutant now, when Jonathan Hickman took over writing the series, didn't want to bring her back because Moira MacTaggert's mutant power is that she resurrects. But she doesn't like resurrect, you know, from the point where she died. If she dies, she resurrects, you know, as an infant and relives her entire life with the knowledge of the life that she had just lived and all lives that she had lived previous to that. When she was repeating some of her lives in a couple of instances, she decided that in order to, like, whenever she would live her life, she would do things a little bit differently to try to, you know, avoid, you know, a massive conflict between humans and mutants and machines, Sentinels specifically, machines built by humans. Whenever she would do things like side with humans or machines, Destiny would, as a precognitive, see what she was doing, stop her, kill her, and, you know, give her like the ultimatum, like, hey, don't do this shit or we're going to keep killing you. We will always know. So when she restarted this, the current life that she is in, which is, you know, the Marvel 616 main universe, she was hiding herself from Destiny when Destiny died. She made it a point to say, like, we can't resurrect her. She's going to ruin everything. So Moira's up to some shit. But Inferno is the story of Destiny being brought back. Mystique went around. She circumvented Xavier and Magneto and went directly to the mutants, the five, the ones responsible for resurrecting people. I was like, yeah, we'll bring her back. And so she is back. She was elected to the Quiet Council, the sort of governing body of the mutant nation of Krakoa. And through a series of machinations with Emma Frost, they brought back the gun that Forge used to negate Storm's mutant powers for quite a time in the 80s. It is a gun that blocks your mutant ability, and they did that to Moira MacTaggert. They shot her with the magic gun, which negates her mutant power, so now she's just back to being baseline human. Now, I can't remember exactly how Storm got her powers back. I think it just kind of came back. Maybe it was through some mysticism. Anyway, not important right now. So, there, you know, it does leave open some possibility of Moira getting her powers back so that she would resurrect herself again and relive her life again if she was ever killed. But as of right now, if she were killed, she wouldn't. She would just die. She wouldn't get resurrected through her powers. And that's pretty much the crux of the story. It's sort of this transition period to where, like, Moira is no longer behind the scenes pulling the strings with Xavier and Magneto. They're losing their grip as the sort of power trio of Krakoa. It's slipping more to Mystique and Destiny and the sort of the loose alliances that they've formed with Emma Frost and Exodus and Sinister. So, who's just an agent of chaos. But, you know, you still have characters like Storm and Nightcrawler and Kitty Pryde, and now a Colossus is on the Quiet Council as well, which is an interesting choice. Not really who you'd think of when it comes to sort of like a governing or leader figure. Everyone else, like as far as like the main X-Men are concerned on that team, everyone else has led the X-Men at one point or another, but Colossus has never really been in a leadership position. So interesting to have him on there. And it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. And like I've said time and time again about these X-Men books, the current ones, they're interesting. Like it's interesting to see like the machinations of all the things that are happening with these stories, and they're interesting to follow, but I don't know where they're going with this, and I'm kind of losing faith that they know where they're going with this. What is this building to? It doesn't really seem like it's building to anything anymore. It's just sort of a continuance of what has been happening, and the things that have been happening, while interesting, they're not in character with what a lot of these characters have been throughout the decades. I don't know. I mean, I'm of course going to continue to read to see how this all shakes out, but this is going to be a hell of a situation for someone to try to reverse when, you know, new writers come on and want to take the characters into directions that they want to go in. They've set up a very isolated ecosystem of a narrative here. It's entirely possible that a writer comes in and just like blows it all up by deciding to ignore it and saying, hey, none of this mattered or ever really happened as far as we're concerned. Just kind of continue on as if nothing happened, which would be very dissatisfying. But man, it's going to take some literary gymnastics to right the ship, so to speak. But we'll see. We'll see where that goes. I did watch a couple of movies that I wanted to briefly tackle. There's an animated movie on Netflix called Bubble. It is not The Bubble, which was the Judd Apatow one that came out earlier in April. This one came out in late April. And it is an anime. It's like a parkour anime where, you know, for some reason, all of these bubbles are floating around this decimated area of Tokyo. It's not post-apocalyptic. It's more of like a Neverland where these orphan children went to go live and then have these like televised games where they challenge each other to a game of capture the flag. High stakes capture the flag where, you know, you could fall into the water and get swallowed up by these whirlpools and shit. Visually speaking, I thought it was pretty good. As far as the narrative was concerned, it was super uninteresting. There's this girl who shows up and sort of like engages with the main lead kid and some sort of like romantic relationship. They kind of become these kindred spirits who are very good at parkour together. But I was never quite sure what the stakes were exactly. Like the lead kid was looking for something. He was looking for like his place in the world, but there was also some sort of MacGuffin. I don't know. I think that a lot about the narrative in this movie fell really flat. And, you know, they kept on engaging with these parkour games, and like there were prizes. Like you got like, you know, food for a month or shit like that. But you never really saw how that affected the losing teams. So, you know, the team that you're rooting for could lose, but, you know, you don't really see the consequences of that. Anyway, I guess this is like a movie that, you know, it's available to stream on Netflix, so it's really accessible. But throughout, you know, a good 70% of the movie, I was playing a game on my Switch and found it really difficult to engage with it. Yeah. Thumbs down, hard pass, don't bother. The other movie that I watched is on HBO Max. It just became available to stream on HBO Max. It's called Chungking Express. I had seen this movie many times before. It is my second favorite movie of all time. I was super excited when this became available to stream on HBO Max because buying a physical copy is prohibitively expensive. There's like a Criterion collection, like DVD, and I think it did come out on Blu-ray a couple years back, but like it sold out so quickly, and now it's like $80 or $90 for a physical copy of this film. It's the director's Wong Kar-wai. He is a film director from Hong Kong. He's done a lot of really great movies that I've liked a lot. This is my favorite one that he's done. His movies are very much about these interpersonal relationships between characters. So many themes of like loneliness and isolation, and, you know, finding that one connection in the world that's going to give you some sort of a basic form of human interaction. Really, really interesting director, really interesting films. And I love Chungking Express. There are basically two stories that take place one after another. First is a story about a male police officer who has just broken up with a girlfriend, and they sort of have this, you don't ever meet her, but they kind of have like this weird estranged relationship where, you know, they broke up, but he keeps in contact with some of like her family members and friends. And there's this woman that he meets who is engaged with drug smuggling and is setting up like the latest trip that she's getting people to smuggle some drugs over to another country for her, and she loses track of them. They abscond on her, so she's trying to track them down, and how they sort of cross paths and have this night together in a hotel room while they're both feeling very lonely and desperate. And then the other story is about another male cop who was recently dumped by his girlfriend. She left him high and dry, and how is it sort of left him kind of destitute. He's stopped like taking care of himself in his living space, and this takeout restaurant, the Chungking Express, that he goes to fairly often, there's this girl who works there, and she is able to, you know, figure out where he lives. She kind of stalks him in a sense, but breaks into his apartment and does things like clean up after him and replace things in the apartment, kind of take care of the place without his knowledge. I think he gets busted a couple of times, but you know, the two share enough of a connection where he's like, hey, what are you doing here? And then like she freaks out, and then he forgives her, and then the situation keeps on happening with him none the wiser, because he's a little bit of an idiot. But yet it is a really hypnotic film. It is so interesting, the interactions of these characters and what the movie has to say about relationships between people, and how complicated or simple they can be, and how it feels to be lonely and isolated. A really amazing movie, really great ending as well. One of my favorite endings to a film ever. And there's actually like a third storyline companion piece to this movie called Fallen Angels. And that movie came out a little while after. And if I remember correctly, it was supposed to be like a third story within the same movie, but it was way too long, so it kind of like the content got trimmed, and then that trimmed content got expanded into its own movie, Fallen Angels. And it really has like a lot of the similar tones and themes, but like it doesn't, like neither of these movies, and Fallen Angels is also really great, but both of these movies don't shy away from any like emotions or tones. Like it's funny when it makes sense to be funny, and it's devastating when it makes sense to be devastating. They're very like complex, but like simple, beautiful films. Really, really great. I really dig them both. But Chungking Express, if you have an HBO Max subscription, watch it as soon as possible. Don't miss it before it goes away. I don't know if it has an expiration date for when it's leaving HBO Max, but do not miss it. Really, really great movie. But that's it. Next up, we're going to do the ghost quiz. We're gonna it's all ready to go. We got our questions, and we're gonna see how Wes and Ryan does with this one. And then after that, we'll do the retro show. It's going to be another really great retro show. Lots of great movies to talk about, as well as a couple of really great Game Boy Color games to discuss, and our last N64 game. This will be the end of the Nintendo 64. We'll probably keep calling it that until the GameCube comes out. Or maybe we won't. Maybe we'll change it to the Nintendo Advance or something. But we'll deal with that another time. One last Nintendo 64. Before we close the book on that system and start delving into the Game Boy Advance and looking forward to the GameCube. And then we will wrap it all up with the official show at the end of the month. That's it. The end.
Mm-hmm.